Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight I am joined by three of my favorite people. First of all, sitting across from me is Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, everybody.
And back from a short vacation is our old friend Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hey, thanks.
And then anchoring it for the rest of the country outside of Utah is Glenn. Hey, Glenn. All right. This is sort of like, we don't have anybody special on tonight. Just the four of us.
Excuse me.
Well, now we've got more people in Utah than not, right?
Yeah. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, and it's not,
it is kind of weird.
Not too long. We're of course moving down to the Utah County. The big UC is going to feel a disruption in the force when John and Zilpha take up their homestead in just a couple weeks.
But I'm the one that's close to Zion.
Oh yeah, you are.
Yeah, I'm just like an eight-hour drive from.
That's
Zion.
That's like Community of Christ Zion. That's not like the true, like Brigham Young Zion.
No. That's, it is the one place that was appointed that shall always and ever be appointed for the gathering of the saints. It says so.
It's true.
Section 10 something.
Isn't Zion now been defined to be like everything everywhere? You know.
No.
Well,
those
that's the liberal definition. The pure in heart.
Where would I go if I wanted to leave Zion? That's my question.
Outside the United States, right?
Wherever it is, you found it, brother.
All right, so we do have a topic tonight. We were having what we call our business meetings, where we talk about what mistakes we've made and what things we'd like to improve. And we were talking about some of the old timey discussions we started with in the beginning. And you know, I thought it'd be a good idea to bring one of those back. And we're sort of kind of resurrecting one of the topics. And, you know, I first gave it the name of what I love and hate about the church, but I'm going to amend that because I'm going to differentiate between Mormonism and the church. But anyway, I get asked two questions probably most often.
Are you single?
That reminds me, as long as we're going off on tangents, there was a study on the University of Florida campus in 1989 where they got a very attractive young woman and a very attractive young man. And the young women went up to kids on campus and said, and the young woman went to men on campus and said, "I've been watching you for a while. I think you're very attractive. I want to know if you'll go to bed with me tonight." 75% of the men said yes. And I don't know what the exact breakdown of the 25% are, but
Do they even exist? The other 25%?
A portion of those said something to the effect of they'd like a rain check. And for the attractive man who approached women, 0% said that they would go to bed with him.
Zero?
Yep. That's according to the study.
Maybe it was men who picked the quote attractive man and they really had no clue.
Yeah, I've never actually read the study. I've heard it quoted more than once, but
who's picking the attractiveness of the man?
I don't know. The study was clearly conducted by a man. I mean, that's clear, right? Okay, so I don't know why I brought that up, but the question I get asked oftentimes by members of the church who know what we're doing here is the old, you know, why can't you leave the church alone? Why do you do this stuff? Why are you interested in Mormonism?
Why do you still care about the church?
Well, yeah. The question I get asked the most by ex-Mormons and their ilk is, how do you do it? How do you keep staying engaged with the church and not go insane? Those are the two. They're really the flip side of the same question.
I guess that's fair.
So I kind of wanted to address that and talk about tonight sort of the love-hate relationship that I know that I have with the church. I know from conversations I've had with Zilpha that she feels about the church. And I don't know, is it fair to say that you guys, maybe you're all hate, maybe you're all love. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, I think
we still go.
Yeah, since both me and Glenn go, I guess we're in different camps, but I think that the analogy used last time when we were talking was it's like a roller coaster. That's what I'd say. It's a love-hate relationship, but it goes up and down. And sometimes it makes you sick.
Glenn sounded like he was about to be sick there for a second.
Yeah, right. It's true. Yeah. Roller coaster is a good analogy. I mean, I've known for a couple of days that we were going to do this love-hate thing, and I've been racking my brains to think about the things that I love, and there are things. It's much easier to make a list of the things that, not hate, but the things that, you know, make you want to pull your hair out. That's easier to do.
What I found when I started thinking about this is that a lot of times the things that I love about the church, I actually hate that about the church also. So, you know, like humanitarian efforts. I love that the church does humanitarian efforts and they do a lot of good in the world, but I hate that they use it so much as a missionary tool. And that's more, I feel like, the motivation for them to do the humanitarian efforts a lot of times. And so I dislike that part. And a lot of the things are like that. There's a flip side to the good thing.
I guess that's there. Yeah.
I do want to, for before I start spewing forth my venom, I do want to I do want to define our terms a little bit more, because we talk about the church, and for me there's really four aspects of the church and of Mormonism. One, you have the culture and the people. You know, when we talk about Mormons, we're talking about a group of people, and their cultural goings-on may or may not have anything to do with Mormonism. For example, in Utah and in the Mormon corridor, there is a strong tendency for gun rights. But that, I mean, that goes all over the West and all over the United States. I don't think that has anything to do with church doctrine.
Yeah, or like Jell-O or root beer.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, vanilla ice cream sells a lot in Utah. And that's a cultural aspect. I don't mean to make fun of those things, but it just, I don't think you can really tie it back to the Restoration or anything like that.
Maybe. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that with root beer, because maybe about 10 years ago, I was going back to Japan, and there was a city called Takamatsu on the island of Shikoku, and they were having, I think it was the 50th anniversary of that stake being formed on that island. And to commemorate the 50th anniversary, they wanted me to bring over some root beer extract. and you know, when they had this celebration, it really wasn't a Japanese celebration. They watched Legacy, which had been translated into Japanese. And I just, you know, I was sitting with all of these people watching their faces and tears streaming down their faces, watching these Western pioneers trek across the, you know, from Nauvoo to Salt Lake Valley, wondering what in the world they had in common with them, but recognizing that they felt this kinship, that they were the pioneers for their own, you know, in some strange way, they felt this kinship. And so even though root, like the Japanese, as a general rule, they don't like root beer. They think it tastes like medicine. Because whatever Utah missionaries had been there, they took this aspect of Utah Mormon culture and kind of adopted it as something that they called home. And it was really interesting. And some of the games that they played, you know, the building that they were in, a lot of the things that they surrounded themselves with was part of this Utah Mormon culture that you're talking about. It was really interesting.
Did you sing them your version of Saturday's Warrior, Glenn?
No, I hadn't conceived of it yet.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was natural to you.
Do they watch things like Saturday's Warrior, those kinds of Utah Mormon things?
You know, when I was a missionary, so going back almost 20 years, they had Johnny Ringo. and that was in Japanese. Wow. They had a lot of those church videos that you know,
what is that, John? Is that the 8-cow wife? Yeah. Mahana, you ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. Which I don't know if I've ever seen in English, but I've seen the Japanese. I don't know about Saturday's Warrior or My Turn on Earth. I don't know if they've seen those or not.
You know what's funny about the Mahana, you ugly thing? My brother took the exact opposite lesson from that movie, and he would call us that. Yeah, trying to make us into, I don't know, half cow wives or something.
Well, I mean, I paid a good solid, what, 2¾? When you start cutting them up, on. I don't understand.
Oh.
you just paid by the hamburger.
No, I paid 10 cows, and I'm still paying today.
Oh, how sweet.
So I'm sorry, I derailed your different. You what, said you want there were
me
four
to,
different.
He's giving me a look like he wants me to argue with him about the value of women.
I was looking
cows.
To see if I was in trouble. That's what I was looking to see. All right, so the culture. Maybe we can just stop here since we already did. I don't have any problem with the culture. A lot of ex-Mormons or anti-Mormons make fun of the culture all the time. The culture is what the culture is. And, you know, I go around, if you go across the United States, there's weird elements of every culture. So some of it I enjoy. I like funeral potatoes. Not a big fan of the carrots in the Jell-O. But, you know, fruit in the Jell-O's all right.
Pineapple.
Yeah.
but to me, that culture part is key. And you know, that's really the answer. For me, at least, to the question that you alluded to earlier, why you can't leave it alone, because, you know, when I think about the things that I love about the church, it's the way that I was raised, and it's the memories that I have, and even the things that have changed in my beliefs and the way that I want to approach my life, it helps to be around people that were brought up in a similar way and that were raised in a similar culture, that were raised to think and process information in a similar way, and culture has shaped that, you know. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it's something that you can make fun of in certain ways, but I think it's really important. And I don't think you can get away from it.
Yeah, and it's fundamental to who we are. And I think that the people who leave the church and try to escape their Mormonness. In the long run, in the short run, I think there's a certain amount of iconoclasm that is important. But in the long run, I think the people who are happier and healthier are those that sort of can re-embrace that and say, yeah, that's sort of what I am.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you tend to live your life as a true anti-Mormon in the sense that you're just taking whatever it is, whatever values and whatever thoughts you had before. And I'm talking about on the small stuff, you know, like ice cream, and just trying to turn it on its head. You know, yeah. If you're going to start drinking alcohol, drink alcohol because you want to. Don't drink alcohol because the church says not to.
Exactly.
So, John, do you think the church is a cult?
Whoa.
I think.
Tom comes back from his vacation and what? Tom says cult before Zilpha says sex.
Well, I wasn't able to participate in the 14 fundamentals, and I could tell John just trying to bite his tongue, not say cult.
I think he did bring out that word in that.
I said it three times. I don't think the church is a cult in general, and I think hopefully the rest of this discussion helps that. There are certainly cult-like aspects. The problem with the word cult is no one can define it. Everybody who uses it as a pejorative, and they're usually evangelical. So, and if you take...
And they're thinking of like Satan worship and seances and stuff.
Yeah, if you take the you know, the textbook definition that, say, an anthropologist would use, there really has to be a personality in there. And I don't think you can argue that the church has a cult of personality now. I think the church was definitely a cult underneath Smith, especially in the Nauvoo period, and by Brigham Young, by all means. I mean the early period through the Reformation. I mean the church was a cult, as culty as you can get. The MTC is obviously a cult. You know, the haircuts and the white shirts, and you can't use your name, and you can't call your family, and all that sort of stuff.
So should we go get an unmarked white van and try to rescue him?
No, I mean, so, you know, what's funny, interesting is some people can thrive underneath that. I dare
it's kind of like the military.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I've said before in arguments about this that if you're going to define the Mormon church or other churches as a cult, you have to definitely define the Marine Corps as a cult.
Definitely.
And so that's the whole thing is problematic. Cult really means small, unpopular religion that we're free to make fun of.
Well, it means that people are sold on the idea so completely that they will do what their leadership tells them to do. That's what it means to me.
Well, I mean, then you have to define most of corporate America as a cult, if you use that definition.
Well, some corporations do run it a little bit cult-like.
So I think you can say there are healthy psychologically or psychologically healthy organizations, psychologically unhealthy organizations. And just like any human relationship, there can be aspects that are healthy and aspects that are unhealthy. And I think for the Mormon Church, it vibrates successfully with some people, and other people, it's not a healthy environment.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome, Glenn.
Okay, so that's the people and the culture. And I love Mormons. I love being around them. You know, I've just recently come back to Utah. I work with a lot of Mormons in Utah County. I just enjoy listening to their little conversations. I overheard a conversation where one young woman in her early 20s was explaining to another young woman how after Satan was bound in the millennium, we would go from a telestial to a terrestrial status, and oh, it just warmed my heart. Okay, so the number two aspect of the church for me is the doctrine. And the doctrine is probably what out of all the stuff that I still enjoy the most. I really enjoy the culture, but I'm fascinated by the doctrine, and that's what I study and I learn about. But for me, I don't take the doctrine I was going to say I don't take it seriously. I don't take it. Glenn, explain to all the good people out there what a myth is.
A myth is a sacred narrative that is ancient. It's outside of historical time, and it exists in a realm of gods and interaction between gods and man. And it most often describes the origins of things, although it doesn't always. So it has this etiological component often, but not always. Myths are usually almost always defined by their sacred nature. So they're believed. They're not only believed by the people who tell them, but they're revered as sacred. That's what myths are, but in an academic definition of myths.
So what the audience learned there is don't ask Glenn a simple question.
No,
Glenn. That's a pretty simple definition.
Well, according to that definition, the doctrines of the church wouldn't be myths, but the Book of Mormon could be considered a myth.
I think you have two things. One, they're tapping into the sort of this universal mythos, and I think what's key and what Glenn was trying to say is that a myth is more fundamental than true and false. It's to teach us something about our values, about our origin, about what combines us and makes us, you know, one. And the truth value of them, although universally people assume them to be true, I think the truth value is sort of irrelevant. But I think you have two things with the church. You have this tapping into these old stories. You know, the podcast that we just put out a week or two ago about the Kirtland Temple, where you see that Joseph Smith was using all these different ideas and bringing them all together. He wasn't just making stuff up. So you have these long threads running way back in time that play out in Mormonism. But also you get to see the foundation of a myth. I mean, that's normally so far in the history that we can't see how it actually occurred. You know, we can read about the Buddha or we can read about Moses, but it's obscured by the fogs of time. And here we have Joseph Smith, who is just right there, right in front of us, and we can see sort of how that works. That's a psychologically fascinating topic in my mind.
Or confusing, yeah.
Well, I guess I would say more the history is what I appreciate, and I guess the doctrine plays into that. But just the pure history of the church is fascinating, and I guess it's partly because of that, because I know what the church grew into and how it is now, just seeing the differences between the historical church and today's church is interesting, and trying to figure out how those changes came about. And how the church became what it is today.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, but I think if John would have said, "Hey, Tom, define myth for me," I think I would have said it. I think I would have said, "It's a story that's made up."
And you'd be wrong.
Glenn would spend the next 10 minutes correcting me. Okay.
Well, I mean, it just depends what your perspective is. That's the most common understanding of myth. And when you're using, you know, myth colloquially, sure, that's the most common understanding. But if you're talking about myth in an academic,
colloquially? What did you say?
Colloquially? How do you say that?
Colloquially?
Are you just trying to bring up big words?
I was distracted because my daughter stuck her hand in to say goodnight to me. Oh. But yeah, never mind.
I do admit, you know, I like the history, but from the time that I first started questioning the church, I love finding out all the little naughty bits.
All the things that have been obscured.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like fishing, you know, when you get that bite on your line.
Yeah, it's true.
When you're reading through some old, you know, manuscript
journal
or something, and you find some little...
Ooh,
yeah, yeah.
Ooh,
that's,
they did that?
That's fun.
Did you look up sex in the topical guide in the Bible dictionary then, John? Is that what you're saying?
Many, many times. Why? Okay. What do you want to know?
Hey, I guess I beat Zilf on bringing up sex, didn't
yep.
I? Sorry about that.
You get the prize. But it has nothing to do with sex.
Yeah.
So you know, love, hate. I love reading the doctrine, especially the changes in the doctrine. That's a big interest to me. And the podcast so far this last year, we haven't had as much time, or we haven't taken as much time to go into it like I would like. I find the differences between, say, the first Book of Commandments and the Doctrine and Covenants to be utterly compelling. And probably, if you're going to ask me if there's a smoking gun to the church not being true, that's it, the changes in those two books. And we need to explore that a little bit more.
Hey, I thought we were supposed to talk about things that we love and hate about the church.
I was about to go, well, I'm saying I love that stuff, isn't that?
Oh, okay.
It does really bother me that especially some of these things that people actually believe. I mean, take, for example, the Tower of Babel.
Oh,
you mean Babel?
Yeah, the Tower of Babel. Whatever.
Babel.
The anybody in the 21st century can actually believe that to be literal just makes me shake my head. It's
a myth.
It's thoroughly disproven. It's the story is ludicrous from its founder. Everything about it is bad.
How has it been disproven?
Linguistically.
Well, linguistically, we have evidence of let's say, Chinese going back further than the Tower of Babel. So to say that all languages originated, you know, in the Fertile Crescent, so some 2,500 or what is it, 3,000 years BCE, it's just untenable as a belief.
Wait, there's evidence of an actual Tower of Babel?
No, there's no evidence of it. There's no link.
Then how is there evidence of Chinese going back past the Tower of Babel?
Well,
from where the Bible says that the Tower of Babel should have been at the time.
Are you trying to play one of those liberal Mormon things like that says, we could have, it could have been long, long ago or.
No,
before Adam and Eve.
I'm just surprised to hear you say that it's been proven that it.
He's saying that the language of Chinese has its roots further beyond the Tower of Babel.
I'm with you, John. It seems completely ridiculous, but I can't go as far as to say it's been proven.
Look, okay,
I've just never seen that.
Well,
it has.
I'm a man who plays.
I'm curious if it has. I'd like to see it.
I play the odds. That's what I do all the time. I play the odds.
It's highly unlikely.
So there's people out there, and I understand the philosophical position that say you cannot prove a negative. But I would counter saying, well, all you have to do is reverse it into a positive, and if you can't prove that, then there you go. There's your negative case. So that where extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, we just say, all right, is there any evidence for the Tower of Babel? No. Is there evidence countering the story? Yes. Okay, it's false.
Yeah, most likely false.
No, not most likely. It's false. I won't let you hold out that. Why do you want to hold out that smidgen of most likely?
I don't know.
No, there's. I don't. If he wants to go 80%, that's all right.
It's like when
I'm like 99%.
Oh, 99%.
It's like when I was first realizing.
I think John, the only reason is just humility, maybe. Just like I don't know.
Or maybe you just haven't studied linguistics enough.
Is it the same with the Adam and Eve story then, Glenn, and the flood?
That's a great question, Tom. I think all those things are highly unlikely. Yeah, I mean,
so
they
you would
seem absolutely ridiculous.
You wouldn't tell your kids, okay, kids, this it might have happened, but it's pretty slim, like that.
I might tell them that actually.
You would say that it probably didn't happen, but it could have.
Like as kids,
yeah.
As their children,
yeah,
yeah. That's probably what I would say to them as children.
Really,
I don't think I would say, "Hey, kids, this definitely didn't happen."
Well, what do you say?
I would say I don't know.
Okay, I run into sometimes I have to explain Christianity to my children, but more often I have to explain like Greek and Roman mythology because that comes up in our culture all the time. I have no problem at all explaining to them that Venus isn't real. Do you have trouble with that?
No.
So
what about Santa Claus?
But you know, no one in their, you know, like their grandmother totally believes all these stories, right?
Right. So they need someone telling them reason.
Right. But I don't want to have to put them in a position with the religion where I'm, you know, like I'm telling them this really hard thing about Jesus or Adam and Eve or Moses or, you know, these things.
What do you mean hard?
You know, wait, Glenn, because I used to think exactly the same as you do, so I can really empathize until I learned that the religious people will give you no quarter. They will not extend the same courtesy to your kids as you're extending.
Not at all.
That, I know. No, I understand that. I know that.
And so it's tough.
When I was babysitting, this is like the worst thing ever. I was babysitting this 8 or 9 year old girl, and I was a teenager, and she had gotten christened. She was a Catholic, and she had her christening? With the white dress, and anyway, and they had this big celebration for her. And I told her that, you know, that I belonged to the true church. And of course, she wanted to belong to the true church too. So I thought, great. But then she told her mom, and I don't think I babysat for her again.
Yeah. Yeah, my kids don't say that.
Yeah.
My kids know not to say that.
But the thing is that I thought I was being a really, you know, I was living the religion. I really believed it, and I thought I should be sharing it.
Yeah.
I've told my kids the same thing that you were telling us earlier, Glenn, that there's myth, and myth is neither true nor false. They're stories. They've been around a long time. And
that's not what I said. I said myths are true and sacred. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to.
It is really hard to know what to tell your kids about this stuff.
Well,
and especially,
let me just throw this question while we're on this tangent. And I don't want to compare.
Glenn will be playing the role of Mike tonight.
Oh, that's what's going
on.
Go
ahead.
Well, because I could answer the same. I could answer the question as well. With Santa Claus, the story of Santa Claus, right? So if your kid's getting to that age where some of the kids are not believing in Santa anymore, but still some of them kind of do, you know, are you going to, how do you approach that? Do you say, well, it's a myth, which is neither true or false, whatever. It's just a story that's made up.
Well,
but then do you tell them to be careful about what they say to their friends?
I think it's a great parallel to the church. I really do. You know, and I'm not being flippant. I think it's a great parallel to the temple ceremony. I think it's a great parallel to like ordinances because I love Christmas. It's one of my favorite things. I love the pageantry. I love putting on the lights, putting up the tree. I love the music.
Putting
this
on
whole
the Ritz.
Liminal experience where you change the world around you from the everyday to make it special and make it different, this a different experience.
I agree.
And if that has meaning and value to you, why would you want to change it? And you know that some things about it are not real, you know? And you know that what you're doing is you're dressing up and that it's kind of pretend, but it's fun.
I don't want to be jumping into the ex-Mormon camp here and play devil's advocate too much, but let's take this other analogy about that then, Glenn. If you're saying that, well, it's, you know, it's nice, it brings us together, blah, blah, blah. Well, what if there's a family that thinks that there's a diamond in their backyard and they're digging for it every Sunday and somebody comes over and says, there's not a diamond in your backyard. Give it up. Well, it's not about finding a diamond. It's about the experience of spending time with your family. I mean, at what point do you say, okay, you know, just say what it is instead of saying, you know, maybe just change the tradition. You don't need to spend all that time in your backyard digging. You know, if you're saying that you're wanting to spend time with your family, spend time with your family.
Yeah, and that's what I wonder, Glenn. Why is the belief in some, saint from the North Pole necessary for all those other things you mentioned about Christmas? I don't see any connection. Are they gone? Tom?
Are they gone?
I'm here. Yeah. So you went on and on about all these things that you do to change your environment, but that doesn't have anything to do with believing in Santa Claus. I mean, isn't it very similar to believing in,
oh my gosh, Zilpha.
The truth of the Bible?
When my kids are going to sleep at night, we look out the window and I point out to the stars and we look for red lights to see if Rudolph's out there.
Why do you want to do Santa's that to your poor little kids?
Are you being flippant, Glenn? Come on.
No. Like when my kids are little, like the nights before Christmas, when I was a little kid, oh my gosh, the magic around Christmas and Santa Claus and Rudolph.
Yeah, but when they find out that that stuff isn't true and that you've been pulling their leg all this whole time.
Let's talk about Christmas at the Larson house. I especially enjoy Christmas, I think, as much as you do. I enjoy the pageantry. I enjoy the religious history. I enjoy all that. But we made a conscious decision. We've never lied to our children about Santa Claus, and I don't think it has diminished it one single bit.
For them.
And I don't mean that as a criticism to you. I'm just saying that oftentimes we say we have to participate in the myth.
Otherwise, it would lose its magic.
But it hasn't. For us, at least.
Yeah, but your kids, just as a side note, your kids aren't telling the other kids that do believe, hey, it's your parents. It's your parents.
No, we've talked to them about that.
They might. Okay, who knows? But we every year we have a big long talk more than once about how they can't.
And they actually feel really special to be in on the secret and everybody else is in the dark.
And we have to tell them, we tell them about, I don't know, once every other month that they're not allowed to tell other people that Jesus is imaginary. And stuff like that. we don't tell them that, but you know, kids make connections.
Well, this is my little side story too. I'm kind of in the Glenn camp. I think that it's good to tell them that there's, you know, that myth is for real and just kind of bask in the magic of it all. Because as my daughter got older and she kind of either figured it out or busted us or whatever it is. And once I explained to her, this is the way it is, she kind of embraced that, and then she kind of encouraged, you know, my little boy and my daughter in on the secret, like, yeah, I think I hear him coming, you know. She thinks it's great too, so it's not all bad.
And it's all a game, but I don't know. I just don't feel, for me personally, I don't feel right about doing that to my kids. But when I know it's not true and telling them that it is true, I don't feel good about that.
All right, so I feel guilty now.
No,
it's just me personally. I mean, I don't have a problem with anybody else doing it because, I mean, that's how we were raised. It's a tradition, and I enjoyed it when I was a kid. I just can't, I personally can't do that. I personally feel uncomfortable.
You know what else I do, Zilpha?
What?
I tell my kids that I have the Force.
Oh, dear.
And I go like this. I make this noise. And then I do it again.
That actually sounds really good in your bathroom environment.
And then I speak in a voice like I'm Han Solo or like I'm Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader, you know, and I talk to them in character, like their spirit has transferred into my body, and they know that I'm not really, but they play along with it.
Right. But when you
tell
a kid ever from the time that they're little that there is definitely a Santa Claus and then you do these secret things to make it seem like, well, maybe there really is a Santa Claus. But when you're obviously you acting like a Star Wars person, that's a totally different thing.
Well, I mean, yeah. and to go back to our theme of Mormonism, you know, yeah. I think there's a lot of liberal Mormons out there who use the same sort of rationale, and I've used it before. We've all used it before. We're all part of the system of that. But you know, you sort of say, well, these are symbols, these are things, da 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 da. They're not serious. But then your kids hit young men and young women's, and what you've done is you put the hooks in those kids for other people to take and start manipulating. And when they get into the MTC, bam. So the unfortunate thing is, yeah, I think there's a lot of people out there, especially outside the Mormon church, who have a healthy view on the mythos of religion. And they take it semi-seriously and they take the good out of it, but they don't take it too serious. They don't go overboard on it. But I think you almost make them ripe for people who want to manipulate them on that front.
You think I'm making my kids ripe for manipulation?
Potentially.
Really?
Possibly. It's happened to us all. Haven't you in your history with the church been manipulated by some priesthood authority or some person based on your faith that they manipulated you to get to their ends? Hasn't that ever happened to you?
I don't know.
Or like, I think magical thinking, and Santa Claus is a magical thinking kind of thing, and training your kids to be magical thinkers.
I don't know. I'm usually the one doing the manipulating.
Exactly.
You mean at home and on the podcast? I'm just kidding.
I mean, I don't know if it's a huge problem. I mean, that's the whole point of John Krakauer's book, right?
Everybody's going to think I'm a humbug now.
No, I mean...
But we really do celebrate Christmas, and we do the Santa Claus thing. They just know that it's us. That's all.
Yeah,
I think everybody's got you envisioned that you're walking in the elementary school saying, "There's no Santa."
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you let your kids drink soda?
What does that have to do with Christmas?
I do. Oh, Zilpha doesn't.
No, I let them drink soda, but I just don't. If they've had a lot of sugar already for the day, I would say no.
All right. So. Yeah.
Anyway, the good things about the church. Where were we?
The things we hate about the church is Santa Claus. All right.
Yikes. That's one of the largest tangents I think we've done.
Okay. So I think it was a good discussion. All right. Let's see. The next aspect of the church. So far I've defined the people and culture, the doctrine and history. The next one is the corporation. Now, this is where most like ex-Mormons and anti-Mormons really start getting bent out of shape. And to tell you the truth, it doesn't bother me as much. I went to business school. I have my MBA. So when I look at the church, I just see them doing things that corporations do. And because I don't assume the church is divine, when they like build a mall, for example, it doesn't bother me because that's what I expect them to do. But, you know, I know there's some ex-Mormons that really bends them out of shape. They really are upset about the $2 billion on the mall. Now, I have to say that when I stopped paying tithing flat, the real reason I did it was because I didn't have any financial transparency. So I was not going to any longer give money to an organization where I couldn't see what they were doing. Zilpha and I, even after we stopped believing, kept paying for a while because our kids were going to nursery or whatever. And we wanted to, you know, support something that we were involved in. But the corporate church, but the one point I do want to make is you have to separate that from the church. And I think what a lot of Mormons do is they do a sleight of hand. People will criticize, say, property dealings the church is in or their lawyers or whatever. And they say, you can't, we're a religion. You can't make fun of us like that. But I think the corporate church and the cultural church are two separate things.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Huh. I guess I can understand the reason why you connect them because, I mean, if the corporate dealings of the church are done by the same religious leaders that are doing the religious themes of the church, I don't know how they can keep it completely separated. Like if, like all the money deals, I mean, didn't eventually, if you go back and back and back, didn't a lot of the investments start from tithing dollars? So you can't really say that
absolutely.
Their hands aren't clean.
No, I'm not trying to exonerate them. I'm just saying when you look at the church, people say, hey, look, the church functions like a corporation. Of course it does. It's a corporation. And when you say ecclesiastical leaders, point me to one. These guys are all businessmen. They run like a board of directors. They're lawyers. They're businessmen. They're executives. They don't even bother putting – when's the last time they put a theologian into office? Hell's bells, I can't even think of one since, like, Joseph F. Smith. Maybe
Robert Millet?
Maybe, maybe Bruce R. You know, people like Hinckley, I mean, he started at the church just right as a young man, as a corporate lackey in the, you know, in basically in the marketing department.
Like public relations.
But aren't they all amateur theologians to a certain extent anyways?
Well, aren't all Mormons amateur theologians? By the time you finish with seminary and institute, yeah, I'd say you're amateur theologians.
I think saying amateur theologians is being generous. Do you guys listen to conference?
Well, but just because what they say in conference doesn't reflect what they actually know.
They don't even understand the doctrine.
They manipulate the doctrine.
Okay, get off your high porch there, John.
No. I mean, you go down to BYU. Those guys are much better understanding the doctrine. Tell me some doctrinal, like, innovative insight you've gotten from the brethren in the last 30 years.
Be more Christ.
I think John's right. I don't think that they read through the history of the doctrine. I don't think that they look at the evolution of the doctrine.
You don't
think
so?
Some do, some don't.
I think they're intelligent.
They did, then they're just being manipulative. So I guess it's giving them the benefit of the doubt to say that, don't.
They don't know the history. If they're being manipulative, I think it's unintentional.
In
most cases.
You got to take Gordon Hinckley.
I think it's intentional, but I think it's the...
You think it's intentional?
Yeah, I think it's the lying for the Lord kind of thing. I think they do it for a righteous purpose in their mind.
But I think that they're aware that they're manipulating. I don't think they're intentionally trying to negatively manipulate.
No, of course they're not trying to negatively manipulate. They think that they're doing the right thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of lying for the Lord. Yeah, you have to either say, either they're nefarious or incompetent. You know, some of the things that Hinckley said, he wrote books. Yeah. And so it's hard for me because at some point you have to say, are they liars? And I don't want to ascribe that to them. I know a lot of people do. it's tough, but now they just select, you know, he's an old time, you know, he goes way, way back. Now you look at the guys they're putting in, the Quentin Cooks and the Bednars. I mean, these guys are corporate lackeys. They're not theologians. I'm repeating myself, but they're just
kudos to you for trying to be positive, though, John.
Well, in
a sarcastic sort of way.
Joseph Smith and Brigham Young always merged the secular and the sacred, and there was really no difference. And since Brigham's death in 1877, there's been a slow, ever so slow parting of the two. And, you know, it's in our lifetimes that they announced, the early 90s, they announced that they were going to pull the general authorities off the board of directors. You know, up until recently, probably 95% of what these guys did was completely secular in terms of running Beneficial Life and being on the board of Union Pacific Railroad and all the different holdings that the church had. You can get old copies of the Improvement Era, And you go to the back page, the back cover is always an advertisement for Beneficial Life Insurance, and always has the president of the church saying how important he thinks it is to buy insurance from Beneficial Life.
Wow.
I mean, there's no separation in terms of just American red-blooded capitalism and the church. And it's only a recent innovation where we started to pull the two apart.
Or pretend that they're pulled apart.
Well, they're not sitting on as many boards. They're still on a lot of board of directors. They've still got their hands all over in the finances. But the idea that these guys sit around and opine over doctrinal issues is just sort of absurd.
All right.
Really?
If they did,
every single 6 months, they have to come out with these talks. They have to discuss, okay, now what do we have to say to, you know, to keep everybody.
Give us our marching orders.
But yeah. That's Exhibit A. They can't even come up with anything out of the.
I know, but that's on purpose.
How could you
I'm sure they talk about it every time, what to say and what not to say.
Okay, here's my question. You got 10 hours of conference, including the priesthood session, and these are supposed to be the best and the brightest. You take any other organization that's as large as the Mormon Church, the people who have the sort of degrees and pedigree that these guys do, and try to come up with anything as boring and as full of palpum as these guys come up. You couldn't do it. It goes beyond the pale.
See, John, the first counselor in the bishopric today stood up and told me and the entire congregation that every time he hears conference, it's easier for him to hear the words of the general authorities.
What does he mean, easier? He falls asleep?
No.
Jeez.
He enjoys it more. He even said that he gets his marching orders for the next 6 months.
But what exactly does he come away with? Because all I hear is the same things I hear every time.
Be more Christ-like.
He I know, but that's the same thing.
God and his marching orders for the next 6 months.
I know, but it's all. But he could just read the one from the 6 months ago and just go from there. Keep marching away.
No, because that was for the last 6 months. This is for the next 6 months.
Oh.
And he also said that he's very disturbed when he hears people disagreeing with the things that are said over the pulpit, and that he did hear some people disagree with some of the things that were said in this last conference. And that you hear that some people thinking as a man, some people will take like a smorgasbord approach and maybe accept, you know, 90% of what's said, but reject 10%, and that's starting to creep into the church a little bit, and that's really scary and it's really unacceptable.
Those damn cafeteria Mormons.
Yeah. And so I got up and I bore my testimony.
Really?
I really did. I was the first one up. And I said, I just have to respond to this. And I want to bear my testimony is that I don't know that the church is true.
Oh. Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me?
I didn't say that.
You said that in sacrament meeting.
I did. And I said, and I'm one of the people that listened to the conference, and I don't agree with everything that said. There's some things that I do agree with, and there's things that I really love, and I gave an example of that from, you know, a couple
wow.
conferences ago.
You have bigger and balls than I thought you had.
Thank you.
Well, nice observation.
And then there's things that I don't, and I gave an example of President Packer, and to, you know. Anyway, and I kind of closed with a positive affirming thing on, you know, Christ and the atonement and charity, and, you know, said, I apologize if I'm coming across harsh. I don't mean to be harsh. You know, I think we need to be more inclusive. We need to be more charitable. We need to be more forgiving.
So could you feel the second counselor over the mute the microphone button?
No. And I mean, I'll tell you what, the person who got up right after me said, you know, I want to, you know, thank Glenn for what he said. You know, I've known Glenn, you know, for many years, and like to sit down and talk with him more. There was a bit of a, you know, a not really quite a firestorm. There were people that got up, but at the very end of the meeting,
there were
the
people that
got
up.
Yeah,
did they grab their torches?
What's that?
Did they grab their torches?
No, no. It really was a pretty good meeting. And at the end, the bishop got up and said that this church. Because one of the things that I said, you know, because I doubt, is there a place for me in this church, or is there no place for me? You know, because of what the first counselor said, you know, is there a place for me or not? And so the bishop at the end, he got up and he said, you know, this church has a rich tradition of asking questions. And Joseph Smith, he asked a question to start this church. And so, you know, Glenn, I want you to know there is definitely a place for you in this church, and anybody else out there feeling the same, feeling similar, there's a place for you. You know, we want everyone to feel included. And you know, it was just a brief message. It was very, very cool. And I had a lot of people come up to me afterwards, and I was surprised because a lot of older people, not younger ones that I would have expected, a lot of older people come up to me and say, you know, thank you for having the courage and the honesty to get up there and say what you said. And
you know,
yeah, it was a good day. I was even the first counselor that kind of inspired that came up to me afterwards and said, you know, what did I say?
No, I think it's cool that it turned out good for you, Glenn. I really am. But
yeah.
I'm also, you know, when you said that story, part of me was kind of sinking down because imagine if your bishop would have got up and sided with the first counselor, and then if he would have made a spectacle of it, which could have easily happened in any other random ward.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I think you were lucky in that circumstance, but
I don't know. I think most Mormons, they don't like conflict, and they'd rather just say, oh, that's great. We'll still accept you. But under their breath, they're like, oh, get this guy out of here.
My bet would be that 9 out of 10 bishops and wards would be like Glenn's. And that speaks to my first point, that I like the culture. I like the people. I think for the most part, you know, Mormonism is good and feeds on the good parts of people. But there's that 1 out of 10 that would follow Tom's scenario. And it does happen all the time. I hear about it all the time.
I disagree out of the 1 out of 10. How, I think it's
more.
Yeah, I do.
I think so too.
You gotta think.
I don't know. I think that there's a vocal minority. And I think that most people are just quiet.
Well, I
thought that too when we went to my sister's baby blessing, and this guy got up and said how people should not even question anything that the leaders say.
There's people like that in every ward.
Yeah, but okay, so I looked around and I was trying to, you know, find some compadres, you know, by looking at people's eyes and meeting people's eye gaze. And a lady that I thought maybe was a compadre, she got up right after him and said, oh, I'm so great. I agree totally with what brother so-and-so just
said.
Yeah,
but most of the people were staring at the carpet, you know.
Yeah.
I think you're both describing valid experiences, because I'm saying 1 out of 10, but probably 60% of those one out of 10s live in Utah County. So I think, Glenn, you're in the mission field, and if you said that kind of stuff in Provo or Orem, you probably wouldn't get away with it.
Well, maybe. This goes to what my biggest gripe was, and as I was thinking about tonight's topic, and I think, you know, to Glenn's point, it you know, his story makes me feel enlightened. It makes me feel better about things. But then after you listen to conference, you know, just when you start thinking that the church is moving in a good direction, where they're kind of breaking off some of those fundamental shackles, as it were, and they're starting to be a little more welcoming. You know, we've got President Packer who says what he does, and then you get 270s reiterating one of the worst talks ever of the 14 fundamentals.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like to me that for at least for some of the general authorities, they kind of feel a little bit threatened, and so they're going to return a little bit to that fundamental roots. You know, like, we need to get defensive. We can't let these damn cafeteria Mormons have their way with us.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was my fourth one. So the first one, the people, the culture, I think we all gave a thumbs up. The doctrine, the history, mostly thumbs up in that we like it. We talked a little about the corporation. The last one I have on my list, I want to differentiate, just like you were saying, Tom, is the leadership. And this is what I would call the church. When people talk about the church, this is my fourth part of what the church is. This are the general authorities, all those people down there at 47 East North Temple or whatever it is in the great and spacious building. This is where I have the most problem. And that's where I was hinting at before. You can understand the accountants in the church. They act like accountants. You can understand the lawyers in the church. They act like lawyers. But there is some sort of moral responsibility that needs to be taken by these guys that is not over and over and over again. And here's a telling example, and then I'll be quiet for a minute. The church loves to put the disclaimer on everything the church puts out that it's not official church policy or it's not official church doctrine. They just love to hide underneath all these layers of bureaucratic inconsistency and historical nincompoopery such that you can't pin anything on anybody. You know, everything can be distanced. Everything can be sidelined. Nothing has to be taken seriously. These guys can get up and say whatever the hell they want with no responsibility whatsoever. You remember like 6 or 7 years ago when there was a talk that was given in, was it Macomb, Idaho or someplace like that? It was L. Tom Perry, and he was making fun of the other guys, and he was about how they eat chocolates in order, and it hit the internet all over the place. But the church responded with a circular saying, you are not allowed to quote general authorities.
Right.
I mean, you want proof that the church is not a noble organization. It's right there. What other organizations have those sort of rules? I don't know. Maybe North Korea. You'd be
easy, easy. Wow.
So when it comes to love, hate, when it comes to the arrogance and the overbearingness and the self-gratification of the leadership of the church and that insular mass down there in Salt Lake City, that's where I have the most problems.
I think you're right for the most part, except for that North Korea reference. I think that it is pretty disturbing. You know, one of the things that the apologists that I always read about the 14 fundamental thing, that they always said, well, that's not official. That's not something the church emphasizes anymore, until this last conference when two general authorities basically read it verbatim. I just, when they say it's not church policy, but then other general authorities get up and they reiterate certain things. Yeah, it's just kind of a big mishmash. I don't know.
I'm waiting for Glenn to chime in.
Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I've never paid that much attention to them.
To the general authorities?
Right.
That's really hard. In the church has such a, the church in general, the membership tends to emphasize that so much. The church, people in the church always say, the church is true, but the people aren't. I would definitely reverse that. I would say people are generally good and true and trying to make things work. It's the church that's slick and corrupt.
Well, hang on a second. I want to go back to something that Glenn just said. You never really thought too much about him. Glenn, if you ever watched conference with President Hinckley or President Monson, and just imagine, since you've got a good imagination and all, if you could just imagine that they actually face-to-face speak with Christ, would that change how you feel? Would you think more about them then? Would you think, oh, maybe I should pay more attention to what they're saying?
Well, let me make a distinction between the first presidency and the general authorities, because the first presidency, I've always been pretty aware of, and I've kind of paid attention to them. The general authorities have always been some kind of a glob.
Are you talking about the 70s?
Or the 12?
Or the 12, because the 12 and the first presidency are kind of lumped together, right?
Not for me. I mean, for me, the 12 and the general authorities are kind of this glob of suits that I haven't really paid that much attention to. I don't have their posters on my wall, and I don't have the trading cards. No, I just haven't really.
But the 12 are prophets, seers, and revelators.
And it was so fun as a kid believing all that stuff. And you're going to, you know, you're going to take that tradition away?
She pulls it out.
None of them had red noses.
What?
None of them had red noses.
Oh, it's not as fun.
Yeah. And none of them were magic.
Well,
they were to me.
The only reason why I bring that up is because I honest to goodness believed that they spoke with Christ, at least the 15.
They're prophets, seers, and revelators.
I used to believe this, and I don't know where I heard it. Was it from seminary or some kooky guy? I used to believe that in order for them to become an apostle, that Christ himself would have to come down to heaven and lay his hands on their head and appoint them as an apostle. So not only did they see him face to face, but blah, blah, blah.
I think it was Joseph who taught that their ordination wasn't complete till it was sealed by Christ. So, and that expectation is from way early on.
I think I may have heard that before when I was a kid. I remember I met President Kimball once, and I shook his hand. And I met President Monson once when he was an apostle. And shook his hand, I was impressed. I was in awe, and I always, you know, perked up in general conference. But you know, I grew up in Arizona, and so when I would watch general conference, it was on TV, and I was always more interested playing with Legos than really watching conference. So I was always kind of bored with it. And I never really cared much about reading the magazines.
Your most zealous time, you know, maybe like even on your mission, you know, before you started breaking all the rules, I mean.
Yeah. Well, that was more about me being the prophet than listening to the prophet.
You were going to be the next prophet somehow.
I was. I was going to find the buried records of the lost tribes that were in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Magical thinking.
Yeah.
It's not too late.
You know, when you get ordained to the Aaronic priesthood, you are eligible to have a ministration of angels. And I didn't take that lightly.
So all of your companions had no idea how lucky they were to be your companion.
Glenn, I'm not trying to bust your ass or anything, but I'm really...
I didn't care.
I'm a little confused. You're saying that when you became a deacon, you took very seriously the sort of supernatural imbuement of power and believed that. But at the same time, you never took the general authorities very seriously?
Yeah, I wasn't really in awe of them. I was very focused on just me.
Okay, fair enough.
Got it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that clear it up for you?
Yeah, I can empathize with that. Yeah.
Okay. What about you, John? Did you used to think that they talked and spoke with Christ and all that?
You know, I always struggled with that from when I was a little kid because I always had a hard time with the metaphysics of the church. Even from when I was little, although I was a believer, I was a strong believer, I really always struggled with the really out there stories like Noah's Ark and, you know, Jesus coming back to life. And
you always struggled with that?
Yeah. Those sort of experiences they describe, you know, like Daniel in the lion's den, just didn't fit with the way that I saw the world, which was very sort of more
like the world is.
Like the world is, yes. So I always, that was my struggle of faith on those things. So I never went away with a strong belief that, hey, the general authorities have seen Jesus. And by the time I was old enough to understand that argument, even as a believer, I thought, well, they hedge too much. That, you know, what the scriptures tell us, both the Book of Mormon and the Bible, is if you've seen Jesus, you just go out and boldly proclaim that. And all the, like, I don't know, you... Elder Packer is a study in this sort of thing. I've been meaning to write a paper on it. He has so much hedging bullshit that he does all the time about it. But you know it's absolutely not true, or he would just come out and say it. You know, they put more innuendo than a you know.
It's too sacred to talk about. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, I was always a little suspicious about that. I think
were Zilpha? I always thought that you were the...
No, I mostly believed it, and I really wanted to believe it, but I always had a little bit of suspicion that maybe they hadn't seen Christ, talked to him face to face. I had no doubt that they were fully inspired by, you know, Christ and Heavenly Father, but I had a little bit of doubt that they actually saw him.
Hmm.
You were just totally convinced that they had talked to Jesus face to face.
Absolutely. I had no reason to doubt because...
Well, they never came out and said it. But in the scriptures, people are saying it all the time.
Yeah, well, I always heard that those experiences are too sacred to talk about.
But that doesn't make sense.
Well, I know.
I think I was with you, Tom. I mean, I didn't doubt it. I didn't think about it that much. I just assumed it. I just kind of expected, oh, yeah, well, of course, the prophet of the church did, and I heard that he did, and thought, oh, okay, yeah, of course he does.
Yeah, because it's like the scriptures, right?
Yeah, right.
Things
he's
happen like that.
That's what he does. Well,
when it finally sunk into me that there was a really, really good possibility that there was no global flood, I still was thinking, no, you know, that's just no. All these scientists are not led by God.
Mm-hmm.
They don't speak. I mean, this so-called scientist who's looking at these mineral samples, he's never met Jesus.
Or maybe Satan kind of mixed everything all up to confuse them.
Yeah.
And when he was putting the dinosaur bones.
Yeah, the dinosaur bones, too.
And the real creepy thing is my way of thinking wasn't really out of the ordinary, at least in my little group. I seemed to fit in pretty well.
I felt the same way about the flood and the dinosaurs, Tom.
Okay. Phew.
And you know, one of my eye-opening experiences was just it came from my own studies when I was a gospel doctrine teacher, and I was teaching about the degrees of glory. It was a doctrine and covenants class, and I wanted to give a little bit more background, and I wanted to give the etymology of telestial. And so I was searching forever to try and find where this word telestial came from. And I couldn't find it anywhere because it doesn't come from anywhere. It's absolutely a made up word.
No, it's in the New Testament.
No, it's not.
It's in the New Testament as the Joseph Smith translation. And so I went to 1 Corinthians 15 and I started reading the entire chapter.
What's actually there?
It's only there as a footnote, as the Joseph Smith translation.
Yeah, reading the Bible as
it doesn't isn't it where Paul says there's celestial bodies, terrestrial bodies, telestial bodies, or something like that? Isn't
Paul
that what you're talking
it.
About?
No. This happened at a time, Tom, when I was teaching English composition class at a state college, and so I was teaching students how to structure their writing. And so I started reading what Paul had written, and I recognized this structure as a binary structure that's very clear if you go and read it. Paul's saying that there's things on earth and there's things in heaven. And the things on earth are mortal, and the things in heaven are immortal. There's death and immortality, you know, Adam, Jesus. Things on earth, like terrestrial. Things in heaven, like celestial. And I went, oh yeah, terrestrial. Terrestrial means earth. Celestial. Celestial means heaven. And he gives examples of things that are on the earth, like fish and plants and man, like different kinds of flesh. And then he gives examples of different kinds of celestial bodies, like sun and moon and stars.
Right.
And that's where the sun and the moons and the stars, they're examples of celestial bodies. It doesn't mean that terrestrial means moon and telestial means stars and celestial means sun.
Well, your problem
there
is
no celestial in there.
Well, you have a major flaw in all this. You were taking a critical mind to sacred word of God. That was your first mistake.
Yeah, wasn't that one of the 14 fundamentals?
And I just saw it so plain, and I went, holy cow. And I tried to explain it to people, and I even introduced it a little bit in my gospel doctrine class, and people are just looking at me with vacant stares. I'm like, doesn't anybody see this?
I have a vacant stare right now.
Yeah,
it was so clear
to
me.
Interesting that word just kind of pops up out of nowhere.
Telestial, yeah.
Yeah.
And people go, oh, no, it comes from telos, like in telescope, because people look through a telescope to see the stars.
What?
Like, oh, come on.
Oh, that seems reasonable.
Telos. Yeah, yeah, because telos means stars and celestial means sun. What?
Well, that's the kind of thing you would hope would come from general authorities if, you know, but, you know, I remember when I first picked up a Bart Ehrman book, you know, one of the thoughts that I had was, well, you know, the church has been teaching for, you know, so long that there was the original church and it went astray. And the more we now can study, you know, if we had general authorities who are theologians, you know, you'd expect them to be reading the Greek and the Hebrew. There's a good reason the church doesn't select people like that, because all the research we've had has led us further and further and further away from the narrative that Joseph Smith made up. You know, he was just filling in the cracks, and a lot of the filling in the cracks has become so embarrassing. I want you to get your mind out of the gutter, young man.
What, filling in the cracks?
Yeah, he laughed at it.
No, I was laughing at the fact that you just said the blanket statement that Joseph Smith made it all up. You didn't even hesitate or nothing. It was just kind of like, whoop.
Of course,
just said it.
Of course he made it up. It's demonstrably, you know, there's stuff. Okay, Elijah and Elias. He just made that up. It's the same guy. It's a misunderstanding of him, a very elementary misunderstanding that he would have picked up in the first year of seminary if he went to theological school. And Mormons go happily along repeating this, and the rest of the world scratches their heads and says, if they know enough to understand what Mormons are saying, it's just an untenable thing.
But the other thing that he made, the winged serpents.
Let's say
that one.
Yeah, I've heard it before. I can't remember if we put it out.
Isn't it possible?
No, you didn't put it out.
Isn't it possible that he was inspired by something? That he was inspired
by something.
I would love to believe that.
But if it wasn't, he wasn't. I mean, because we could have this debate forever, and this is something for another day. But if you know the motivations of Joseph Smith, was he intentionally trying to deceive? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, he had to have been. Just study Nauvoo polygamy and what he was saying to Emma.
Okay,
he was lying to Emma all the time.
Polygamy.
It shows his character.
But he was a megalomaniac.
Okay, we're talking about the church and the doctrine.
He thought that everything came out of his mouth was from God.
Okay, wasn't it Jesse Gauss where he had a revelation from God? God speaks through Joseph Smith, gives him a revelation. Jesse leaves the church, and I can't remember if it's Jesse or somebody else. They replace him with another guy, and they pencil out the one guy's name and just write in another guy's name. We could go on and on for hours giving examples of blatant dishonesty, forgery, and fraud by Joseph Smith.
Mistakes.
A lot of them weren't mistakes. They were going back and trying to make things look better than they,
sure,
than they were.
Okay, well.
But they weren't.
Did you read?
It's a lie.
Did you read America? The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation? Mitch Horowitz book?
Occult America? Is that what it is?
Yeah. I haven't gotten to that one. No, I haven't.
Like, If you get to that one, Mitch Horowitz talks about several religious leaders who had incredible memories and an incredible ability to just pull out arcane spiritual knowledge.
Right.
And but one of these guys, I wish I remembered what his name was asked, how do you how do you know all this stuff? And the response was, you should know better than to ask how a spiritualist knows what he knows. He just knows it. And well, as he's, go ahead.
Tom. Well,
go ahead, Tom.
Well,
I know if I don't interrupt Glenn sooner or later, it's going to, it'll just go on. I'm just saying, you know, we could debate Joseph Smith's intentions and his motivations for polygamy. I think that leans a little more suspect. Yeah, I agree. But I'm talking about the spiritual aspect of it, the building of the church, the fact that he feels like God was talking to him, that helped him bring forth the Book of Mormon and yada, yada, yada.
Here's
yada,
what
yada.
Joseph had going for him. He was like a magpie, and he would surround himself with people who were spiritual and intelligent, and he would take whatever they were bringing in and just build it into the church, sometimes for bad, a la John Bennett, sometimes for good.
But a lot came from just him, we can debate whether he's getting it from other people or books or whatever, but there's still a part of it.
He was getting it from other people.
Fine.
And from books.
I'm saying that there's still a portion of him that's coming from him that he believes is coming from God.
Tom, that's probably a whole other thing.
He does think he's a spiritual leader, just like a lot of cult leaders believe themselves to be. No, it's true. They really honestly believe that God has called them to a special purpose and that they speak for God. They honestly believe that. Yeah. So what makes Joseph Smith any different?
Yeah,
because I guess I just have a problem with the impression that Joseph Smith was intentionally out to deceive. I think he was.
There's a great studies everybody should read about. I wish I could remember the name of them, but they're in the Philippines. They're these like homeopathic doctors, and they do this practice where they reach into people's guts. And they pull out the bad elements.
Like pieces of cloth or
No, they do it by palming chicken guts. And they do it in a very, they push down and they hold these packets of blood. And if you see it, you can watch them. There's plenty of film of them doing it.
Well, I've seen them pull out cloth too.
They'll pull out all sorts of stuff. But it's a sleight of hand trick. They know it's a sleight of hand trick. But they still believe what they're doing is somehow
healing.
Yeah, so they know they're committing a fraud. They know they're not doing what they say they're doing.
And I think Joseph Smith
an Evans Pritchard book called "Witchcraft Among the Azande" that does the same examination of that exact same thing. Private Africa. But Tom, because I let you go, this book, Occult America,
is
a study about people, and it does touch on Joseph Smith, because we have, you know, you had Mitch on a previous Mormon Expression episode. And there are other people who were spiritualists similar to Joseph Smith that also had access to this knowledge. How did they get it? Were they frauds? Were they hoaxes? Were they in touch with some kind of divine power? Were they spiritually reborn, reincarnated from past lives? were they in touch with a cosmic friendly brother from another planet?
All unanswerable questions. Even to go back to John's analogy with the sleight of hand trick, I think that's a bad analogy only because they knew that it was a fraud at the beginning. And I think it's debatable that Joseph Smith actually knew he was doing a fraud.
Okay, let me ask you this.
I think it's just debatable whether he started out intentionally to deceive.
The healers aren't starting out intentionally to deceive. They're starting out to heal. They learn it from other healers who they believe are real, true healers. And this is the way you heal people. It's not like they're trying to deceive people. They're trying to heal people.
No, that's I think that's a better analogy. Hey. Just because they honestly think they're doing what's right.
Right.
They think that what they're doing is actually working, and they actually believe that God is talking to them.
1826 court records show that Joseph was setting out to deceive right from the very get-go.
Well, okay, if 1826, but let's take 1832.
I've got one from 1832.
What if,
as soon as you're ready.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, Joseph Smith is with a group of men. They traveled from Kirtland to Independence, Missouri. Okay. They're getting ready to go back from Independence, Missouri. Like they've gone from Independence, or they've gone from Kirtland. And when they were in Kirtland, they were talking about, this is our last winter in Kirtland, because now we're going to go to Independence. It's going to be a land flowing with milk and honey. We're going to build Zion in Independence. It's going to be great. This is the land that the Lord wants for us. They get to Independence. They see that it's not a land flowing with milk and honey. Now the revelation comes to the Lord saying, it's going to take 5 years to build up. So the Lord wants Joseph and Sidney to go back to Kirtland and have Oliver stay in Independence to build up the church. And then Joseph will come back in 5 years. So the revelation has changed. Now, when Joseph and Sidney Rigdon are going back to Kirtland with this group of men, the Lord gives Joseph a revelation that all of the men need to pool their money together so that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon can take a carriage, a coach ride, back to Kirtland while the other men walk.
Uh-huh.
Is that the Lord? Or is that possibly Joseph Smith using a revelation
the real question,
to get a coach ride?
The real question is did Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon really believe it was the Lord? That's the question that I'm trying to ask. And
yeah,
and I think,
what does it sound like?
It doesn't really matter what it really sounds like. Well, it does and it doesn't. I think all I'm saying is there's a possibility that even in that circumstance, they really did believe that the Lord was telling them to do that.
Well, they might have had this strong feeling like, oh man, we have got to get back. This is horrible. And that to them, that strong feeling came from the Lord. So, you know.
Possibly.
I don't mean to be legalistic, but just because you believe that what you're doing is good doesn't excuse you from fraud under the law. I mean, if you rob a bank for good purposes, you're still robbing the damn bank.
Sure. Yeah, I don't disagree with you there.
All right.
And Tom, I want to believe the good about Joseph Smith. I really do. Like I said earlier that I didn't really pay much attention to the general authorities or whatever, but I really had a lot of respect for Joseph Smith when I was growing up. He was a hero. And when I would listen to those Joseph Smith tapes that were done by Truman Madsen, you know, I just loved those things. And I would love for that Joseph Smith to be the real Joseph Smith. So I would love to give him the benefit of the doubt. But when I hear things like that, it just kind of makes me go,
I totally agree with you. And it does give you that moment of home. Yeah. But in my opinion, I have a lot more admiration historically for Joseph Smith than, let's say, Brigham Young.
That's not hard to do.
Those are two different eggs completely. And I think that Joseph Smith showed a lot more, how do you say it?
Well, he was at least more charismatic.
Yeah, he was much more charismatic. But I think he also showed, in my opinion, a lot more potential to actually be genuine.
He was a loving guy.
He was more kind to people, definitely.
Very generous. Very open-hearted.
Well, and he did show a lot of instances where he could have been acting for God.
He had a great insight to human nature at times, and at other times he would flub it up badly, but you know, he could get thousands and thousands of people to love him and hang on his every word. I mean, that speaks a lot to him.
Brigham Young never really cared about the loving side of things.
I mean, just in response of your little analogy there, Glenn, your little story, how do you explain Joseph Smith ordaining Elijah Abel to the priesthood and then all that getting rescinded through Brigham Young? I mean, you can't say, well, that was just Joseph Smith. I mean, how do you really explain that? That seems so out
Joseph
of character.
Joseph was accepting.
Well, I know, but if a lot of people say that the racism started in the Book of Abraham or in the Book of Mormon with the white
Delights. Well, essentially, the whole country was racist at that time.
Well,
right?
the entire Book of Mormon teachings and the early teachings of the church are all very racist.
Yeah, but then you look at Joseph Smith doing something like that to Elijah Abel, then it makes you think.
Well, that goes with Joseph Smith's teachings from the Book of Mormon about the redemption of, you know, of the colored
fallen
folks.
Races.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they could become white and delights them. So that doesn't surprise me that he would do it, but that doesn't necessarily redeem him, you know, from his overlying racist views.
Yeah, I don't think it redeems him either, but I do think it's a moment where you have to really ponder it a little bit and think, well, maybe his intentions weren't clearly as designed as I originally thought.
You know, there's times that we wonder what would have happened if Joseph Smith had lived. I think the great thing about Joseph Smith and the great thing about that question is nobody has any idea. It could have gone in any direction, and that's sort of the charm of the guy. Who knows what he would have come up with next?
I agree.
All right, so love and hate. Let's bring it back home and
and head to bed.
It's been a fun night of a lot of tangents.
A lot of tangents.
And I've let them all go. Not that I had any other choice, but partly because I think it speaks to the underlying question. You know, that there's so much here. There's so much that's interesting, and we can reverse opinions. You know, there's times when I'll be really polar on some of these things, and I'll come out of conference sometimes and I'll just be so pissed off at them,
seething
mad. And there's other times I do have to say that sometimes I pretend to be a little bit madder than I am, but that's okay. There's
charlatan.
It's the Smith in me. But that's what's great about it. There's times when I listen to myself here and I think I'm being too subdued. There's times I listen to myself, I think I'm being too over the top. But these topics are so strange and so rich and so enjoyable to talk about and think about. And that's one of the things I love and hate about the church, I guess.
Yeah. I love how pervasive it is. And, you know, I love that there's a forum like this to be able to discuss it. Because it was missing for me for a long time. It's one of the things that growing up in the church, I loved being able to have these late night discussions with my friends where, you know, staying out in the car or going on campouts, having these crazy discussions about the gospel, staring up at the stars, wondering what it's going to be like to create a planet someday, you know, speculating.
Gordon Hinckley broke your dreams with that one, right?
No. You know, speculating what it was like, what made Lucifer fall from heaven. You know, I mean, just like all these crazy things, or how many planets there were in the original planet. I mean, there's so many different things that you can take in Mormonism, and you know,
yeah,
so I don't know. And you can still have those conversations, and this is a place, at least a little bit, where that can still happen. So Mormon Expression is a great place to love, and some of the things to hate, maybe.
All right. Any more parting thoughts?
I just think that for my love-hate relationship with the church, it's pretty bipolar, and it fluctuates like a roller coaster. I can leave church very at ease and at peace with certain things, and sometimes I get infuriated, but there's so many good people in the church. There really is. Even in my own ward, phenomenal people. And even if they believe that there was a global flood or whatnot or whatever, it's tough for me to turn my back on them all the time. Sometimes I just have to think, what's that old beat up cliche? Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I want to echo that. I agree with that. And that's where I was saying before, you know, the people are perfect. I mean, they're obviously not, but I mean, there's tons and tons of really good, great people. I even think back to in this last conference talk by Packer, you know, a lot of people got really mad at his talk. I just felt sort of bad for him. I felt like he was an old guy with old thoughts, dating back a century, trying to make sense of a world that has left him behind. And he's been preaching something for so long and it no longer works. And he's just a little kid lost in the woods. I just wanted to give him a big hug because I didn't feel any animosity towards Packer for that talk at all. I thought he was dead wrong, but I think he was trying to do it out of his warped understanding of what's good and right. And I think that's what the church mostly is people trying to do the best they can with what they have. And that's what makes 80% of it great.
Cool. Yeah. Yep. I agree.
We didn't even get to talk about sex tonight.
It came up a couple times.
You mentioned the hug.
What, the filling the cracks?
We could talk about masturbation. How many people?
Tom,
do you think?
Every time with you, it's masturbation.
Yeah, I know. Every time with me. Yeah.
All right. Well, as always, the discussion continues at the website at MormonExpression.com, and we all check that. So if you want to, you know, get into a debate with Glenn about his choice of whatever, you're welcome to do it over there.
Whether he's the center of the universe or not.
And what else? Oh, you can send us an email at mail@MormonExpression.com. As a matter of fact, for all of the regular Mormon Expression players, you can send them emails respectively at Glenn, Zilpha, Jim, Tom, Niall, John, @MormonExpression.com. And yeah, we're happy to answer as much as we can. All right. Till next time. Thanks, everybody.